Marshall, please call the next case.
The third case is A24-0182, State of Minnesota Appellant B. Clifford Robert Letourneau III, Respondent.
Good morning. As you probably each know, you'll have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There's a timer on the center podium. Feel free to adjust it as you need. And we are recording arguments today, so please introduce yourself and identify your client at the beginning. Let us know if there are any particular pronunciations we should be aware of. And the recording will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. So, with that, Mr. Smith, you may begin when you are ready. The clock has been set for 15 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith. I represent appellant State of Minnesota in this appeal. Respondent engaged in non-consensual vaginal intercourse with the victim. As he did so, the victim began to cry, her vagina tore, and she began to bleed from her vagina. By doing so, respondent committed first-degree criminal sexual conduct in violation of Minnesota Statute Section 609.342, Subdivision 1, Parens D. because he engaged in sexual penetration with another person while using force. But the district court dismissed that charge for lack of probable cause because it concluded that the statute requires respondent to use force to accomplish the act of penetration. At the heart of this case, then, is a question of statutory interpretation. Does the statute, which makes it a crime to engage in sexual penetration with another person while using force, require that the force mentioned in the statute be used to accomplish the act of sexual penetration? The answer to that question is no, and the district court erred when it held otherwise. Here, force means the infliction by the actor of bodily harm, and bodily harm in turn means physical pain or injury, illness, or any impairment of physical condition. Nowhere in the language of Section 609.342 Subdivision 1 Parens D, or in the definition of force, is there any requirement that the actor use force to cause the victim to submit or to accomplish the sexual penetration? Yet that is precisely what the district court here held after concluding that the legislature must have unintentionally and inadvertently omitted such language from the statute. Then, based on that erroneous legal conclusion, the district court dismissed the first degree criminal sexual conduct charge. But the legislature in 2021 amended Section 609.342 by separating force and coercion. And when it did so, it did not include the requirement that the force be used to accomplish the act, which it retained with regard to coercion. These amendments represent a considered policy judgment by the legislature that when the defendant uses force while engaging in non-consensual sexual penetration with the victim, and the victim suffers bodily harm, the act is serious enough to be criminalized as first-degree criminal sexual conduct, even if the force is not used to accomplish the act of penetration. The district court's decision to supply words that the legislature omitted rides roughshod over this legislative policy judgment and thwarts rather than effectuates the intent of the legislature. What,
was there some legislative history that surrounds that recent change?
I'm sorry, Judge.
Some legislative history that surrounds that recent change?
I'm not aware of anything in the legislative record, but what's of particular note here is the fact that the predecessor statute used force. It had a provision, which I noted in the brief, that made it a crime. This is 609.342 subdivision 1 parens E parens little Roman numeral one in the 2020 version of the statute. The actor uses force or coercion to accomplish the act. So prior to the change, force and coercion were together in the same provision, and that provision required...
My question is, do we know why the legislature made the change?
I can't point to anything in the legislative record to demonstrate why that change.
Have you
was
checked made. The legislative history on that?
I didn't actually on this case. But I think the legislative intent is abundantly clear from the way it structured the statute. What it did is it made it a first-degree criminal sexual conduct charge anytime the actor engages in non-consensual sexual penetration and uses force or coercion, and that results in bodily injury, bodily harm, or physical injury. When it's just coercion, or when it's force that doesn't meet the first definition, the infliction of bodily harm, there's the added requirement of the complainant suffers physical injury in the new statute. So I think even if there's nothing in the legislative record, and that's my fault for not looking, there certainly is clarity from the statutory structure about what the legislature's intent was when it removed this requirement from the use of force.
So you're saying without legislative history, the plain language gets the result that you want?
That's correct. The state's position is that the plain language of the amended statute eliminates any requirement that the force be used to accomplish the act. I don't think there's any way other reasonable way of reading the statute. And even if the statute's ambiguous, then the prior versions of the statute where that requirement previously was there demonstrate the legislature's intent, because amendments to the statute are presumed to change the law. And I think that it's particularly instructive here that the verbs used are present tense verbs, all of them. The statute has an actus reus, which is engages in sexual penetration with another, if any of the following circumstances exist. So we have engages and exists in the present tense. Then it has an attendant circumstance. The actor uses force as defined particularly as the infliction of bodily harm when you get down to it. So all three of these verbs are in the present tense. That indicates that they're all happening together. Not that there's any one of them that must precede the others in time. All the statute requires is co-occurrence. It doesn't require a causal or other temporal relationship, as respondent contends. And I think this interpretation is reinforced by the Supreme Court's decision in In Re Welfare of DLK, which I cited in my brief, where the Supreme Court held that even under the prior version of the statute, it's the fourth degree criminal sexual conduct statute, but it uses the same language except with sexual contact. The requirement of force is satisfied when the actor inflicts bodily harm or pain, or the threat thereof, based on a different, slightly different definition of force at the time, on another while accomplishing sexual contact. This case is no different than In Re the Welfare of DLK, other than this is sexual penetration rather than contact, and we have actual injury instead of just the threat of bodily harm or pain that was a possibility under the statute in question there. Those things taken together, it's a well-settled principle of statutory interpretation that when the Supreme Court has placed a construction on the law and the legislature continues to use that language, that it adopts that construction, all of those things taken together here demonstrate certainly when the legislature removed words of limitation to accomplish the act in 2020, it didn't intend to make it harder for the state to prove a first degree criminal sexual conduct charge than it had been prior to the amendment. That defies reason to suggest that taking words of limitation out of a statutory provision represents the legislature's intent to make it more difficult or to add an element to the statute for the state to prove. This court reached a similar conclusion in State v. Williams, again, cited in my brief, that even under the pre-2021 definition of force does not require the actor to use infliction of bodily harm to cause a victim to submit. In that case, this court held that there was sufficient evidence that force was used to accomplish penetration to sustain a conviction when the victim felt pain from the defendant putting her penis in her vagina, caused her pain by holding her hips down, and it hurt when he tried to perform oral sex on her. In sum, even under the pre-2021 law, the evidence here is sufficient to establish probable cause for the charge. It mystifies me how the district court could come to a conclusion that under an amended version of the statute, where the legislature took out the words that the district court said it must have just forgotten to include, that even if those words were there, there would have been probable cause for the charges here under this court's decisions, under the Supreme Court's decisions. That demonstrates conclusively that the district court here erred when it dismissed these charges for lack of probable cause. I want to briefly touch on the respondent's argument that the state's interpretation creates surplusage. And as I pointed out in my brief, this fails for three reasons. First, respondent ignores two important and operative distinctions between subdivision 1C and subdivision 1D. 1C requires both that the actor cause personal injury and the existence of one of the attendant circumstances specified in Little Roman numeral 1 through 3. None of those circumstances is the use of force as defined in 609.341 subdivision 3 clause 1, that is the infliction of bodily harm. Second, the definition of physical injury in 1C is not limited to bodily harm. Instead, it includes things like severe mental anguish, pregnancy. That is, this section criminalizes substantially more conduct than section 609.342 subdivision 1 parens D does. Indeed, subdivision 1C applies under circumstances where subdivision 1D never will. And the fact that there might be some overlap, some cases that could be charged under both 1C and 1D doesn't create surplusage. I would point the court to the Supreme Court's decision in Thonsavon for an explication of that principle. Third, respondent's interpretation, not the state's, creates surplusage. If, as respondent claims, the requirement that force or coercion be used for the purpose of engaging in the sexual penetration is part of the legislature's choice of the verb uses, then there was no need for the legislature to require that the force or coercion be used to accomplish the act or to cause the complainant to submit in the other provisions of 609.342. That is to say, if uses necessarily it requires the proof of the purpose to use the force to accomplish penetration, the legislature didn't need to bother specifying further in the other clauses. That creates real surplusage in the statute and is contrary to the legislature's manifest intent. In sum, the district court erred when it dismissed the first degree criminal sexual conduct charge against respondent for lack of probable cause, because the statutory requirement that he use force requires nothing more than that he cause the victim physical pain while engaging in sexual penetration. Accordingly, the state respectfully asks this court to reverse the district court's dismissal of count one and remand for trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will turn to counsel for respondent. There are 15 minutes on the clock. Again, feel free to adjust the podium and remember to introduce yourself and your client. You may begin when you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the respondent this morning, Clifford Letourneau. We are requesting that this court affirm the district court's order dismissing the charge of first-degree criminal sexual conduct for lack of probable cause. To start, I would like to make clear that the issue before this court is not whether non-consensual sexual penetration is a crime. Rather, the issue in this case focuses on how the legislature distinguished more severe criminal sexual conduct offenses from less severe criminal sexual conduct offenses. And as the plain language of the statute makes clear, the legislature did not intend that every time the victim suffers bodily harm, that offense is automatically the most severe degree of criminal sexual conduct.
What kind of intent do you ascribe to the legislature in making this recent change?
Your Honor, the statute is not ambiguous, so we don't get to legislative history.
That's not my question.
From the plain language of the statute, it is clear that the legislature did not want to criminalize merely causing bodily harm as first-degree criminal sexual conduct.
And that's a change from the prior law?
That's right. So in the prior law, it included the language, as the state was arguing, accomplished the act and caused to submit. That is no longer there. And that is not what we're arguing on appeal. I understand that that was in the district court's order, but we are not arguing that. The plain language of the statute, which uses the verb causes, to cause, so the language says, or sorry, uses the infliction of bodily harm to engage in criminal or in sexual penetration, that on its own establishes that the bodily harm has to be separate than the actual sexual penetration. So it's not to accomplish the act, which under Williams we know a case like this would fit under it. It's not that at all. It has to be separate from the actual act of sexual penetration. And that comes from the plain language and the change from the earlier statutes. But the state relies on the earlier statutes as if that's the law now. And we have to look at what the plain language of the law is now. And it doesn't include that language, which would actually support the state's argument, the to accomplish language. But that's not there anymore. The language that's there now, the actor uses force.
Is this an argument you made to the trial court?
Say it again?
Did you make this argument to the trial court?
I was not the trial attorney. Yes. That argument was not specifically made, but we have the ability to argue when we're not trying to expand the relief on appeal to get to the exact same result. And the state has not objected at all to the idea that we can make this argument now and reach this conclusion by making different arguments and a different interpretation. The question before the court in this case is to interpret the statute and to determine whether Mr. Letourneau's conduct, whether the state established probable cause. And we're interpreting the statute, and what we're arguing is that the plain language clearly establishes that the defendant has to use
the rule that we've used many years. You have to raise a specific issue for the trial court before you can come here and raise it is not applicable here.
Well, Rule 2904 Subdivision 6 makes clear that respondent can make other arguments on appeal in order to preserve the same ruling on appeal. So we can interpret the statute when we're looking at the plain language, which ends up being the exact same result.
Not sure this is the same ruling as the trial court made.
It's ultimately a different interpretation of the statute, but it gets to the same result of what the state has to prove, and that the state did not prove that in this case, or did not present enough evidence to establish probable cause. And again, the state never made the argument that this was waived below. This was waived, and that we are not able to make this argument on appeal. You won't find that in their principal brief or in their reply brief.
I'm at least positing it as an argument here.
Yeah, and I think if you look at Rule 2904 Subdivision 6, it clearly states that this is how statutory interpretation should work, is that we're not bound by the argument below, because if our argument is correct on appeal, we don't want the incorrect interpretation of the statute to be what's applied below. We want this court to look at the plain language of the statute, determine if it's ambiguous. If it's not ambiguous and it supports our argument, this court should rule that way. We're not making an extremely different
proposition is that you can make any argument about statutory construction before the trial court, and you can ask that result be affirmed here, even though the argument is totally different.
Well, I wouldn't say it's totally different. We're making the same argument that the state has to prove the same thing. It's just interpreting the words in a different way. And again, it's the judge included, as the state indicated, the accomplish the act and cause to submit language, which isn't in the statute. And we agree with that, but that's not our argument. When looking at the plain language, the legislature made clear that the state has to establish that the defendant used the infliction of bodily harm. In order to use something, that thing has to exist. The state wants this court to read the statute to say that any time bodily harm is caused, therefore it's a first-degree criminal sexual conduct offense. And the legislature didn't write the statute that way, and they know how to write the statute that way.
And they didn't use the word use either.
They did use the word use. Uses bodily harm.
Okay. There you
go. Uses force. Uses force.
It says uses force.
Yep.
As defined in, it doesn't say uses force to and then fill in the blank, right, though.
So uses force. Force is defined as
the infliction of bodily harm.
Correct. So uses the infliction of bodily harm. So you have to use the infliction. It's not cause the infliction. It's not cause bodily harm. It, earlier in the statute says caused bodily injury in a different portion of the statute, but here the legislature uses the infliction of bodily harm. And again, the legislature could have very clearly written the statute if it wanted every single offense where bodily harm is caused to be a first-degree criminal sexual conduct offense, and it didn't do that.
How is uses the infliction of bodily harm different from the actor uses force or coercion to accomplish sexual penetration?
So uses the infliction of bodily harm, and then the actus reus is engages in. So you have to use the infliction of bodily harm to do something, right? No one uses a pen, and we don't know what they're using it for, or uses this microphone. You have to use it for something. And what's the actus reus? It's it's sexual penetration. It's engage in sexual penetration. So the infliction of bodily harm has to be used for that. And again, if the legislature could have written this a lot differently, and they didn't do so.
Have you checked the legislative history?
Your Honor, the statute is not ambiguous.
I didn't ask that question.
Yeah, no, because it doesn't. We don't need to get to that point because the legislative history does not come in.
The answer is no.
The answer is no. That's right. So
you both are in agreement by the plain words, except you're in disagreement of what they mean.
Right.
So, counsel, you indicate that the statute is not ambiguous. I guess I question, is the statute ambiguous? That being that your analysis of uses the infliction of bodily harm indicates that it uses the infliction of bodily harm to accomplish something. Uses is a transitive verb, which means it's connected to something. So if it's uses the infliction, it seems to me the state's argument is just merely using the bodily harm accomplishes first degree criminal sexual conduct. Doesn't that create an ambiguity, which means we need to then turn to the canons of statutory construction?
So just to be clear, our interpretation is not uses the infliction to accomplish the act of sexual penetration. I admit that under that interpretation, if you want to read those words into it, under Williams and the Supreme Court decision.
But you're indicating there's an additional actus reus. So you're not saying that it just is uses the intentional infliction of bodily harm, right?
Right. The actus reus is to engage in sexual penetration, which is what the statute says.
Okay.
Right. So our plain language reading is the plain language. It is use the infliction of bodily harm to engage in sexual penetration. What the state's argument is cause bodily harm while the infliction.
I guess really what we're trying to figure out is what is the meaning of uses, right? That we have a disagreement as it relates to what uses mean.
Not only that, I don't even think the state is acknowledging that uses exists in the statute. They're not making an argument that this court should include uses in the definition. What they're saying is causes bodily harm. Our argument is you should look at the word uses and actually, I don't want to say it, but uses and apply that word, that verb, when interpreting the statute. And that you can't disregard that verb uses. It has to be for something. Otherwise, then I don't know why the legislature wouldn't just write it to be to inflict bodily harm, you are then guilty of first-degree criminal sexual conduct. But that's not what the statute says, or cause bodily harm. And as C says, the actor causes personal injury, uses the verb causes. The legislature could have very easily done that in D, but instead included the verb uses force, which is the infliction of bodily harm. And as far as our surplusage argument, I want to be clear again under C that if the state is correct, the state will never have, if there's bodily harm, the state would never charge anyone under C because personal injury is the same thing as force, as bodily harm. So anytime there is personal injury, they would charge under D and not under C because the state wouldn't need to prove prongs 1, 2, or 3 under C. They would just go directly to D, where all they would have to prove is any sort of injury.
Counsel,
which doesn't make any sense.
How do you respond to the appellant's argument that under subdivision C, personal injury is more expansive, that being that it's not just causing great bodily harm, but pregnancy and other more expansive definitions?
That's absolutely true. And I think for those other parts of it, the pregnancy, of course, they would charge it under C. But anytime there's personal injury or just the bodily harm part of it, which the legislature included under C, they would no longer need to charge it under C. They would just charge it under D. And the way we are interpreting it, that C and D are completely different, which is what the legislature intended. And that with D, you actually have to use the infliction to engage in the sexual penetration.
So in terms of what this court does with all of this, it'd be insufficient in your view that we would simply say trial court was wrong. You want us to say what the interpretation is.
Yeah, I think this is the first time this statute has come before this court as an error-correcting court that can also interpret the law and issue published decisions.
You want us to do all that, even though that issue wasn't raised before the trial court?
The issue raised was whether there was probable cause.
Or the argument wasn't presented before the trial court.
The argument was that the state did not present probable cause that Mr. Letourneau violated the statute. The court did its own analysis, interpreted the statute, had a difficult time with it. I think we can all agree it is not the easiest statute to interpret, and it's different than the old statute, and this is the first time this statute has come before this court. So if this court were to just reverse and say we disagree with the district court, then I also don't know how the district court would provide jury instructions to the jury, how we would move forward in this case.
Or decide the probable cause question.
Or decide the probable, absolutely. I think once a case like this gets before the court, just to punt it back and say you're wrong with no guidance really doesn't get us anywhere. And again, Mr. Letourneau has the right to stand before the court and make sure that the state proves their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And if this court has a better interpretation of the statute than the district court, based on the plain language, it should do that. And I think this is a great case for a precedential opinion as well, because other courts across the state of Minnesota are starting to try to interpret the statute. And as we can see from this, there are some questions. We believe our interpretation is clear in using the plain language, not using adding new words to it and requiring more than just causing bodily harm. The state thinks that every single time somebody causes bodily harm, they can be charged with first degree criminal sexual conduct. And that can't be the case. So if the court doesn't have any other questions, as I indicated, we are requesting that this court affirm the district court's order and dismiss the first degree criminal sexual conduct charge, and the remaining criminal sexual conduct charges will still be in place. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, the clock will be reset for 5 minutes. We turn back to counsel for appellant for rebuttal. So, counsel, you may begin when you are ready.
Well, I hope my friend Mr. Erickson doesn't fall off his chair, but I agree with him on a few things. First of all, I agree with him that the respondent has the right here to argue for an alternative interpretation of the statute as an alternative theory for affirmance under State versus Grunig and Rule 2904. I think that's pretty clear. The general claim was raised before the district court. This is a refinement of the respondent's argument. And I think it's entirely appropriate for the respondent to make that argument here. That's one of the reasons I didn't argue in my reply brief that this was waived by not being raised below. And I agree with him that this court does need to interpret the statute in this case in order to resolve this case, because that's the district court needs guidance. And I also agree that this probably is an apt candidate for a precedential opinion. Then we might start to diverge.
This is the end of the agreement.
This might well be the end of the agreement. It was happy while it lasted, hopefully. First of all, the state is not asking this court to ignore the word uses in the statute. The state's interpretation of the statute gives effect to the word uses. Uses is a transitive verb, as has been noted. That means it takes a direct object. But what it doesn't necessarily mean is that it has to have an indirect object. The direct object, and I hate to descend into the weeds here of grammar, but I think unfortunately this is where we have to go. The direct object of uses here is force, which is defined as the infliction of bodily harm. Respondent is arguing that there's an unstated indirect object to uses. That unstated indirect object is the infinitive to engage. But the statute doesn't say to engage. And the definitions of uses do not require that the use be for a purpose. The definitions of uses include to put into service, to avail oneself of, or to employ. It doesn't necessarily, by definition, require to employ for a particular purpose. Now, rational human action usually dictates that we do things for a purpose, but the fact of the matter here is that when the legislature wants to specify an indirect object for the verb uses in the statute, it knows how to do so, and it does so. And that's demonstrated in subdivision 1C, little Roman numeral 1, uses coercion to accomplish the act. 1E, little Roman numeral 1, the actor or accomplice uses force or coercion to cause the complainant to submit. Every time the legislature wants to specify an indirect object for the verb uses, it does so. It used to do so with relation to force as defined here. It doesn't anymore. The law is clear. The courts presume that amendment to the law changes the law. And the amendment here eliminates any indirect object to the verb uses when coupled with this definition of force.
Don't disagree with you, Mr. Smith, but I am curious. I'd like to hear you respond to respondent's argument that subdivision 1C, small numeral 2, and subdivision 1D are, for all intents and purposes, now rendered the same.
And I did find one more point of agreement. I think respondent has conceded that there's not complete surplusage between these two provisions, that what there is overlap. As he conceded in response to Judge Harris's question about pregnancy and emotional harm, just because there are these differences, there are some overlap, meaning the prosecutor could choose to charge a particular case under either provision, that doesn't mean they're surplusage. Thone Savan is crystal clear on that. And again, I think the other thing that's helpful here is respondent points out C uses the verb causes. But it uses causes personal injury, which is a differently defined term than force as bodily harm. And it uses those uses. It's almost impossible to avoid using use in numerous ways. I thought about that when I was writing the brief here. I don't know if you could construct an entire sentence with uses, but we could try, I suppose. It uses the verb uses for coercion and force. And it specifies indirect objects for coercion. So I don't think that that gets us a whole lot anywhere. Again, there's overlap. There's not surplusage. There's plenty of work for 1C to do. And I see my time has expired. I would ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So thank you to both attorneys for the argument here today, as well as the briefing on the issues. It's been very helpful. And the case is submitted, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. That ends the oral portion of today's calendar, and the court is in recess. Thank you.
Please rise.